What's going on? One of my patrols coming in. Mac narrowed his eyes. There must be some new development. He stopped speaking as he realized that Sapper could not understand him, and then his expression changed as he recognized the small, slim figure that was being carried on a rough litter by the men of his patrol. Tessé saw him running towards her and sat up weakly on the litter. The men lowered her to the ground, and Mac went down on his knees beside the litter and placed both his arms around her. They held each other in silence for a long moment. Then Mac gently cupped her face in his hands and examined her swollen and scarred features. Some of the burns had become infected, and her eyes were slits beneath the bloated lids. "Who did this to you?" he asked softly. She mumbled incoherently through her black scab lips. "They made me." "No, don't try to talk." He changed his mind as her lower lip cracked open and a droplet of fresh blood welled up and glistened like a ruby on her skin. "I have to tell you," she insisted in a broken whisper. "They made me tell them everything. The numbers of your men. What you and Nicholas are doing here. Everything. I am sorry, Mac. I betrayed you." "Who was it? Who did this to you?" "Nogo and the American, Helm," she said. And although he embraced her as gently as a father with his infant in his arms, his eyes were terrible. The lower chamber of the tunnel was cleared of gas at last. Ansith's fire burned bright and steady in the middle of the floor, the rising hot air wafting away the noxious vapours and dispersing them through the upper levels of the maze, where they mingled with the cleaner, oxygen-rich air and lost their toxicity. By this time, Royan had fully recovered from the physical effects of the gassing, but her confidence was shaken, and she allowed Nicholas to lead the way up the steps that rose from the far side of the chamber. "It's the perfect gas trap," Nicholas pointed out to her as they climbed cautiously. "No doubt at all that Taita knew exactly what he was doing when he built this section of the tunnel." "Surely he must have expected any interloper of his period to have either succumbed to his hellish devices, lost his way in the maze, or given up and turned back by now," she reasoned. "Are you trying to convince me that this was Taita's last line of defence, and that he has no more tricks in store for us? Is that it?" Nicholas asked as he took another step upwards. "No, actually I was trying to convince myself and not having much success. I just don't trust him one little bit anymore. I have come to expect the worst from him. I expect the roof to collapse on me at any moment, or the floor to open and drop us into a fiery furnace, or something worse." They had descended 40 steps down into the chamber, and the staircase they were now climbing was a mirror image of that. It rose at the same angle, and the tread of each step was the same depth and width. As their heads rose above the 40th step, Nicholas played the beam of the lamp down the spacious level arcade that opened before them, and they were dazzled by a riot of colour and pattern, bright and lovely as a field of desert blooms after rain. The paintings covered the walls and ceiling of the arcade, stunning in their profusion, wondrous in their execution. "Taita," Royan cried in a voice that quivered and broke. "These are his paintings. There is no other artist like him. I could never mistake it. I would know his work anywhere." They stood on the top step and gazed around in wonder. When compared to these, the murals in the long gallery seemed pale and stilted, the tawdry sham that they really were. This was the work of a great master, a timeless genius whose art could enchant and enrapture now just as readily as it had 4,000 years ago. They moved forward slowly, almost involuntarily, down the arcade. It was lined on each side with small chambers, like the stalls in an Oriental bazaar. The entrance to each was guarded by tall columns that reached up to the roof. Each column was a carved statue of one member of the pantheon of gods. Between them they held the high vaulted ceiling suspended. As they drew level with the first two stalls, Nicholas stopped and squeezed her arm. "The treasure chambers of Pharaoh," he whispered. The stalls were packed from floor to ceiling with wonderful and beautiful things. "The furniture store," Royan's voice was as reverential as his, as she recognized the shapes of chairs and stools and beds and divans. She went to the nearest chamber and touched the royal throne. The arms were twining serpents of bronze and lapis lazuli. The legs were those of lions with claws of gold. The seat and back were chased with scenes of the hunt, and wings of gold surmounted the high back. Stacked behind the throne was a great profusion of other furniture. They recognized a screened divan, its sides enclosed in an exquisite lacework of ebony and ivory. But there were dozens of other items besides, most of them broken down into their separate parts, so that it was not possible to guess what they were. They gleamed with precious metals and coloured stones in such confusion and variety that it was too much to take in a single glance. Both the alcoves on either side of the arcade were stuffed with these marvellous collections. Royan shook her head in wonder, and Nicholas led her on. The walls that separated the alcoves were decorated with panels illustrating the Book of the Dead and the journey of Pharaoh through the pylons, the dangers and the trials, the demons and the monsters that awaited him along the way. "These are the paintings that were missing from the mock tomb in the long gallery," Royan told him. "But just look upon the face of the king. You can see he was a real person. Those are perfect royal portraits." The mural beside them depicted the great god Osiris leading Pharaoh by the hand, protecting him from the monsters that crowded close on either hand, waiting their chance to devour him. It showed the face of the king as he must truly have been, a man with a kind and gentle, if rather weak, face. "Look at the figures," Nicholas agreed. "They are not stiff wooden dolls, always stepping forward with the right foot. These are real men and women. They are anatomically correct. The artist understood perspective and had studied the human body." They came to the next pair of alcoves and paused to peer into them. "Weapons," said Nicholas. "Just look at that chariot." The panels of the chariot were covered with a skin of gold leaf so that it dazzled the eye. The harness and traces seemed only to await the horses that would draw it into battle, and the quivers strapped to the side panels behind each tall wheel bulged with arrows and javelins. The cartouche of Mamoz was emblazoned on the side panels. Piled beside this magnificent vehicle were war bows whose stocks were bound with wire of electrum and bronze and gold. There were arrays of daggers with ivory handles and swords with blades of glistening bronze. There were racks of spears and pikes. There were shields of bronze, the targets decorated with scenes of war and the name of the divine Mamoz. There were helmets and breastplates made from the skin of the crocodile, and the uniforms and regalia of the famous regiments of Egypt dressed the life-sized wooden statues of the king that stood in rows against the walls of the alcoves. They walked on down the aisle, between more paintings and murals depicting the life and the death of the king. They saw him playing with his daughters and dandling his infant son. They saw him fishing and hunting and hawking, in council with his ministers and his nomarchs, dallying with his wives and concubines, and feasting with the priests of the temple. "What a chronicle of life in ancient times," Royan breathed with awe. "There has never been a discovery remotely like this before." Each of the persons in the panels had obviously been drawn from life. They were real, breathing, living men and women, every face and every expression different, captured with the keen eye, the humour, and the great humanity of the artist. "That must be Taita himself," Royan pointed out the self-portrait of the eunuch in one of the central panels. "I wonder if he took poetic license, or was he truly so noble and beautiful?" They paused to admire the face of Taita, their adversary, and looked into his searching, intelligent eyes. Such was the skill of the artist that he watched them as keenly as they studied him. A small, enigmatic smile played on Taita's lips, The painting had been varnished, so that it was perfectly preserved, as if it had been painted the day before. Taita's lips seemed moist, and his eyes gleamed softly with life. "His complexion is fair, and his eyes are blue," Royan exclaimed, "although that red hair is almost certainly dyed with henna. It's weird to think that although he lived so long ago, he almost succeeded in killing us," Nicholas said softly. "In what land was he born?" "He never tells us that in the scrolls. Was it Greece or Italy? Was he from one of the Germanic tribes? Or was he a Viking stock? We'll never know, for he himself probably did not know his own origins." "There he is again in the next panel." Nicholas pointed down the arcade to where the unmistakable face of the eunuch appeared in the throng that knelt in homage before the throne on which sat Pharaoh and his queen. "Like Hitchcock, he seems to like to appear in his own creations." They went on past the treasure stalls in which were stored plates and goblets and bowls of alabaster and bronze chased with silver and gold, polished bronze mirrors and rolls of precious silk and linen and woolen cloth that had long ago rotted to shaggy black amorphous heaps. On the walls that divided these from the next set of stalls, they saw reenacted the battle with the Hyksos in which Pharaoh had been struck down, the arrow shot by the Hyksos king lodged in his breast. Then, in the next panel, Taita the surgeon bent over him with the surgical instruments in his hands, removing the blood-smeared barb from deep in his flesh. Now they came to alcoves in which were stacked hundreds of cedarwood chests. The boxes were painted with the royal cartouche of Marmoz, and with scenes of the king at his toilet, lining his eyes with kohl, painting his face with white antimony and scarlet rouge, being shaved by his barbers and dressed by his valets. "Some of those chests will contain the royal cosmetics," Royan murmured, "and some of them will be Pharaoh's wardrobes of clothing. There will be costumes in them for every occasion in his afterlife. Oh, I long to be able to unpack and examine them." The next set of wall panels showed the marriage of the king to the young virgin, Taita's mistress. The face of Queen Lostris was rendered with loving detail. The artist gloated on her beauty and exaggerated it, his brushstrokes caressing her naked breasts and lingering on all her virtues until they epitomized feminine perfection. "How much Taita loved her," Royan murmured, and there was envy in her voice. "You can see it in every line he drew." Nicholas smiled softly and put his arms around her shoulders. There were hundreds more wooden chests stacked in the next alcoves. Painted on the lids were miniatures of the king decked in all his jewellery. His fingers and toes were thick with rings, and his chest was covered with pectoral medallions. White bangles of gold adorned his arms and bracelets, his wrists. In one portrait he wore the double crown of the two kingdoms of Egypt united, the red crown and the white, with the heads of the vulture and the cobra on his brow. In another he wore the blue war crown, and on a third the Nemes crown with gold and lapis wings that covered his ears. "If each of those chests contains the treasures depicted on its lid," Nicholas broke off, unable to continue the thought. The possibility of such riches was daunting, and the imagination balked at the magnitude of it. "Do you remember what Taita wrote in the scrolls? 'I cannot believe that such a treasure was ever before accumulated in one place at one time,'" Royan asked him. "It seems that it is all still here, every single gem and grain of gold. The treasure of Marmoz is intact." Beyond the treasury there was another alcove lined with shelves on which stood the Ushabti figures, dolls made of green glazed porcelain or carved from cedarwood. They were an army of tiny figures, men and women from all the trades and professions. There were priests and scribes and lawyers and physicians, gardeners and farmers, bakers and brewers, handmaidens and dancing girls, seamstresses and laundry maids, soldiers and barbers and common labourers. Each of them carried the tools and accoutrements of his or her trade. They would accompany the king to the afterworld and there would work for Pharaoh and would go forward in his place if he were ever called upon to perform a service for the other gods. At last Nicholas and Royanne came to the end of this fabulous arcade, and found their way closed off by a series of tall, freestanding screens. Tabernacles that had been once fine white linen mesh, but were now decayed and rotted into ribbons and streamers, dirty and shabby as old cobwebs. And yet the stars and rosettes of shining gold that decorated these curtains were still hanging in the mesh, like fish in a fisherman's net. Through this ethereal web of silken wisps and golden stars, they could make out the shape of another gateway beyond. "That must be the entrance to the actual tomb," Royanne whispered. "There is only a thin veil between us and the king now." They hesitated at the threshold, gripped by a strange reluctance to take the final step.